The first case on this morning's call is number 064251 and related cases, the United States against Robert Sorich et al. Mr. Klein.
May it please the court. My name is John Klein, and I represent appellant Robert Sorich. Your Honors, I would like to, I'm happy to answer the court's questions, of course, but I'd like to talk about honest services fraud, section 1346, and particularly the personal gain requirement in light of Bloom and Thompson. And the issue that we're focused on, of course, is whether the gain in the personal gain requirement has to be to a co-schemer or whether it can be to anyone, including a non-co-schemer. To start with Bloom, the court in that case, this court in that case, was confronted with a very broad statute, section 1346, and felt the need to find a limiting principle, some way to confine it within an intelligible core so that people in the future would know what the statute prohibited. And the limiting principle that Bloom divined from prior cases was that the defendant had to misuse his office or her office for personal gain or private gain. The court used both terms. And the examples that Bloom gave of personal gain or private gain all involved gain either to the defendant or to his co-schemers. For example, Bloom used the example of a judge who took kickbacks in return for decisions, favorable decisions, or a lawyer who misused his client's confidential information for his own benefit or for the benefit of another client that he was in league with. Those were the core examples that Bloom found to form the paradigm examples of the misuse of office for personal gain or private gain. Now let's move forward to the Thompson case, which is the most recent discussion of that. The opinion came out April the 20th. Both sides have submitted letters addressing it. Thompson, I think, is critical to understand this issue. Ms. Thompson, as I'm sure the court is aware, was charged with honest services fraud under Section 1346 and alleged to have manipulated the Wisconsin procurement system to obtain a travel contract for a company called Edelman Travel. And the government's theory in the case was that Edelman was less qualified than another company, but for political reasons, Ms. Thompson orchestrated the procurement process to make sure that Edelman got the contract. And the case turned in this court on the question of personal gain or private gain. Did the government establish that Ms. Thompson satisfied, or that the government had satisfied, that requirement for honest services fraud? And I think it's important, because it's not entirely clear from the opinion, to understand what the government was arguing constituted the private gain or the personal gain in that case. And with the court's permission, I'd like to just read a short statement from the government's brief in the Thompson case, because it lays out very clearly what the government's theory was. And I'm reading from page 54 of the government's brief in the Thompson case. We quoted from page 22 of the government's brief in the Thompson case in our reply brief. This is very similar to what we quoted from. Here's what the government said at page 54. It said, that's Ms. Thompson's actions, resulted in private economic gain to Edelman Travel. Now, to jump in for a second, that's the company to which Ms. Thompson allegedly steered the contract. Her actions resulted in private economic gain to Edelman Travel in the form of a $750,000 contract award, to the governor in the form of $10,000 in campaign contributions, that's money that Edelman had donated to the governor after the award of this contract, and to Thompson herself in the form of a $1,000 bonus. Moreover, Thompson steered the contract in order to attain other non-economic benefits, such as political advantage for her superiors and, as a result, increased job security for herself. Such private non-economic benefits also constituted private gain. So that was the government's argument in the Thompson case.
But in the Thompson case, a lot of the behavior she engaged in could be considered innocent behavior. And here we have a situation where the patronage scheme involved lies, false entries, and cover-ups. Why should we read Thompson so broadly that it protects this misbehavior?
Because the issue is not the whether there was an intent to defraud in this case. We are acknowledging for purposes of appeal that the evidence was sufficient on the element of intent to defraud. Now, it's arguable that in the Thompson case, there was no intent to defraud. But the issue that the Thompson case turned on, the issue that this court found decisive, was whether there was personal gain or private gain under Bloom and under Section 1346. And on that question, whether there was concealment and cover-up and so on, is really, if I may, Your Honor, I think it's beside the point. There was some evidence of concealment in Thompson. If you read the government's brief in that case, they had evidence that she had made some effort to cover up her politically motivated efforts to help Edelman. But I would say, Your Honor, all of that is beside the point. The question in Thompson, the question on which that case turned, and the question on which this case should turn, is whether there was private gain, or more precisely in this case, whether the district court's jury instruction on that issue was correct or incorrect. And the private gain arguments that the court, that the government made in Thompson, parallel almost exactly the private gain arguments that the government makes here. Here, the government argues that there was private gain to the defendants themselves and to their co-schemers in the form of jobs, promotions, salaries, and so on. Now, Thompson has said pretty categorically that that type of gain doesn't count. That's not the sort of private gain that Bloom had in mind. So what's the other gain that the government says occurred in this case? Political advantage to people who are not alleged to be co-schemers, free political work to people who are not alleged or proven to be co-schemers, and then, of course, the jobs themselves that went to people who were politically connected in some way, who did political work for a political organization. But those people as well are not alleged or proven to have been co-schemers in this case. So the government, the main argument that the government is making in this case on the question of private gain really focuses on people who were neither alleged in the indictment nor proven at trial to be co-schemers.
Well, what about the Lombardo case? Because I understand your argument is that the private gain must be personal gain. In Lombardo, the private gain went to a senator to whom the defendant sold property at a low price. So the gain really didn't go to the defendants, did it?
Well, Lombardo... I'm sorry, Your Honor. I didn't mean to interrupt. Lombardo is not an honest services case. Lombardo is a money or property case. And the Bloom analysis, which was followed then in Houseman and most recently in Thompson, is an honest services analysis. Lombardo has no discussion of honest services at all. It was purely a money or property case, and the analysis in that case is limited, in my view, entirely to money or property fraud under Section 1341. The whole point of the private gain requirement in Bloom was to take the vague honest services language, which is devoid of any concrete meaning by itself, and impose upon it some form of limiting principle, something, some core of meaning that courts and litigants in the future could look to say, aha, this is what private gain means, this is what honest services means. And the principle that the Bloom court settled on after rejecting, for example, a requirement that there be a violation of state law was misuse of office for private gain. Solely, though, Your Honor, in the context of honest services fraud. And the private gain that the court has now recognized, first in Bloom and now in Thompson, as forming the core of the private gain that counts for purposes of Section 1346, is gain to the defendant or gain to a co-schemer. And again, the examples that Thompson gives are the same kinds of examples that were given in Bloom: bribes, kickbacks, payments that rob the public servant of his independence and his fiduciary duty to the populace and to the city in this case. That didn't happen here, of course. There was no evidence of that. But more importantly, the district judge's jury instructions didn't require any finding by the jury that there was private gain to either the defendants or to the co-schemers. It could be private gain to anyone. And if that were the rule, and Thompson is to the contrary, Bloom is to the contrary, but if that were the rule, that private gain to anyone counted, there would be no limiting principle. Because in any case involving any kind of transaction, there's going to be a gain to someone. It invariably happens. Thompson's a perfect example. The travel agency in Thompson got $750,000 as a result of the alleged fraud of Ms. Thompson. The governor got a $10,000 campaign contribution as a result of the alleged fraud of Thompson. If those kinds of things counted as gain for purposes of Bloom, it wouldn't function as a limiting principle at all. There would be no limit. And I think the court's decision in Thompson makes it absolutely clear that those types of gains to non-schemers don't count. What the kind of gain that counts is gain to the defendant or to the defendant's co-schemers, and not just any gain to the defendant or the defendant's co-schemers. Certain types of gain, for example, promotions, salary increases, job security, those don't count. And again, that goes back to the core of Bloom and the core now of Thompson, the core of this limiting principle for Section 1346, which is we're talking about people who are corrupted. People who are corrupt, people who judges who take payments in return for favorable decisions, public servants who take kickbacks to secretly favor one person over another. That's the core of honest services fraud. That's really what Bloom and Thompson have limited honest services fraud to. And that limitation, we would contend, is essential for the constitutionality of Section 1346 to provide fair notice, to avoid rule of lenity issues, and also to avoid the kind of federalism problems that arise if the federal government is given free rein to impose its ethical views on state and local governments. I see that I'm into my time, and I'll save the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. We'll hear now from Mr. Deedy.
May it please the Court. My name is Patrick Deedy, and I represent Appellant Timothy McCarthy in this case. I'll be happy to answer any questions that we've on our brief, but in my 4 minutes this morning, I'd like to address one issue that we believe warrants the reversal of the conviction of Mr. McCarthy and the entry of judgments of acquittal on both counts 2 and 5 of the indictment, which he was convicted, and that is the government's failure to establish in this case that the mailings charged in counts 2 and 5 were in furtherance of the scheme alleged by the government in this case. On appeal, the government contends that these two particular mailings, which were both job notification mailings from various departments within the city of Chicago, were somehow necessary for the concealment of the scheme. The problem with that analysis is that when you look at the evidence in this case, none of the co-schemers, both who testified and who were whose testimony came in or statements came in through co-conspirator statements, ever either discussed or conceived or devised anything with respect to these particular mailings such that they would meet the standard of Schmuck. In the Schmuck case, the court said that the question is whether the mailing is part of the execution of the scheme as conceived by the participants at the time. And when you look at the testimony of co-schemers like Mary Jo Falcon, who was a personnel director in the sewers department, she testified that the mailings that are at issue here, in fact, the one mailing to Mr. Henderson, which is count two, there was no particular interest by her whether or not that particular mailing was, that particular letter, which was introduced into evidence, was mailed, was hand-delivered, was sent through inter-office mail, or was sent at all. In fact, she conceded that the sewers department was not particularly very good at mailing these notices out to both the applicants who received the promotions or the jobs, or to the people like Mr. Harness, who received a letter telling him he did not get the position in the building department, which was the subject of count five. I think when you look at the other testimony and evidence in the case, for instance, in the streets and sanitation department, there was clearly no evidence of any regular course of business in which these particular mailings were sent out. There was no requirement that they be sent out. And the government didn't really prove that, in this case, there was anything to indicate that it would be necessary to conceal the scheme.
Well, didn't the Harkness letter provide some cover of legitimacy, gave at least the impression of legitimacy and order in the hiring practice?
Well, the problem is that there was no indication that particular letter, whether it was sent or not, would have prompted Mr. Harness to do anything. In fact, that letter was 4 or 5 months after he was interviewed, and it was at a period of time when the particular hiring had already been disclosed to have been in part of this improper activity by the defendants. So Mr. Harness's letter, I think the government never proved that it would have prompted him to, the failure to get the letter would have prompted him to investigate or make further inquiries, because in fact a lot of times none of these letters actually ever went out, and there's no indication in the record that they were necessary, they were determined or considered by the participants to be necessary to conceal the scheme. I see that my time, I'll save the remainder of my time for rebuttal, unless there are other questions from the court.
Thank you, Mr. Dee. You're now for Mr. Blagan.
Morning, Your Honors. My name is Patrick Blagan, and I represent appellant Patrick Slattery. Mr. Slattery is the appellant here who contested the sufficiency of the evidence regarding intent to defraud and knowledge for the sole count of his conviction, count six. And I'd like to address the Thompson opinion again, but maybe in a slightly different way than Mr. Klein did. The Thompson, as the court indicated, some of the conduct by Ms. Thompson was described by Judge Easterbrook's opinion as innocent. I'd like to read some of the claims that the government made, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Milwaukee, made regarding Ms. Thompson in their brief. They claimed that Ms. Thompson rigged the process, that she made false scores on rating forms, that she fraudulently inflated scores, that she manipulated scores, that she infected the process with political favoritism, and that she based decisions on political non-merit reasons in violations of the law. That's essentially, not word for word, but pretty close to the same allegations they've made regarding Mr. Slattery. The government's position is that Slattery is guilty of mail fraud, both honest services and property deprivation mail fraud, both of which we've contested on appeal, the sufficiency of them, because he filled out these subjective rating forms much like Ms. Thompson did. And in fact, similar to Ms. Thompson, he did so at the request of not only his direct supervisor, but with the knowledge and the consent of the head of the Department of Streets and Sanitation, Al Sanchez. And as one of the witnesses testified at trial, Al Sanchez and IGA negotiated over who should get certain jobs and promotions. After weeks and months, they made that decision. They passed it along to Mr. Drumgold, and Mr. Slattery assisted Drumgold in filling out the rating forms to comport with the higher-ups' decisions. That is very similar to what happened in Thompson. And the government's suggestion in their recent 28J letter that there was no intent to defraud in the Thompson case, I think, certainly would be disagreed with by the Milwaukee U.S. Attorney's Office. Ms. Thompson negotiated over scores. She attempted to convince others to change their ratings on certain forms. And according to the government, afterwards, she lied about the process, indicating that she couldn't remember how she had scored Edelman travel in the first place, and that she didn't understand why other people were saying they felt pressured to score Edelman travel higher. The fact of the matter is that there's more of an intent to defraud in the Thompson case than there is, at least for Mr. Slattery, in our case. The government also indicated that there's a holding in Thompson, in addition to the holding regarding the private gain. The government said that one of Thompson's holdings was a public employee whose conduct was designed to pursue the public interest as the employee understood it does not have an intent to defraud. And as we said in our 28J letter in a footnote that I wrote for Mr. Slattery, that if that is a holding of Thompson, then Slattery has to be acquitted. Judge Easterbrook, in the Thompson opinion, wasn't talking about the public interest as Ms. Thompson understood it in the sense that Edelman travel was much better than the others, or that somehow the other committee members were giving higher scores to other people for non-meritorious reasons. Judge Easterbrook was suggesting and said that she could have very well been simply relying on the bona fides of, or not questioning the bona fides of her boss. That's exactly what happened with Slattery here. There's also, I believe the government is reading Thompson too narrowly. Judge Easterbrook discusses therein political decisions and how political decisions are made, and essentially I believe what he's saying is that you can't impute an intent to defraud to a subordinate for doing what his boss wants him to. That's not a following orders defense. It's a defense of government is complicated, politics are complicated, and when an employee does what his bosses want him to do in that context, you can't impute an intent to defraud, particularly here where there's no other evidence of an intent to defraud.
So Mr. Slattery's falsification of hundreds of interview forms, you would just say that was done at the direction of his boss?
I would also say it wasn't falsification. What the government's real argument is not that they're false. They don't know if truck driver A is better than truck driver B. What they're saying is that he filled out the forms contrary to the manner in which they were supposed to be filled out by the personnel rules and by Shackman. Coincidentally, they presented no evidence that Slattery was ever even presented with the personnel rules, knew about them, or had any understanding of Shackman. I see that my time is pretty much up, but I'll rest on that.
Thank you, Mr. Plagan. We'll hear now from Ms. Giacchetti.
May it please the Court. My name is Cynthia Giacchetti. I represent John Sullivan. Mr. Sullivan was not convicted of the mail fraud. He was convicted of one count, count eight, of making a false statement during an FBI interview. I'd like to use my time, obviously, to answer any questions you may have, but to focus on the insufficiency of the evidence. That the evidence in this case was insufficient to prove the charge statements, the falsity of those statements, or the intent of my client to make false statements. This court in the Martellano case, which was a case involving perjury in front of the grand jury, spoke about the various standards relevant to determining the sufficiency of the evidence in when a person is charged with perjury in the grand jury. Those cases usually also applicable to 1001. And one of the important things is to look at the context of the interview. And the government bears a burden in the context of an interview, and that is to ask specific questions and to follow up general with more specific questions. I'd also refer the court to the Jiang case, another reversal on 1001, January of this year, using similar analysis. In this interview, this was a nearly two-hour interview covering a variety of subjects, numbering more than a dozen. The false statements that are charged literally took about a minute of discussion. They constitute, in his notes, two lines. They are of a topic that was not covered in any depth, and no follow-up questions were asked by the agent to determine the important issue that Martellano mentions in questioning is, are the agent and the person answering the questions understanding them the same way? That just wasn't done. This is exacerbated by the fact that the agent, when he testified, admitted that when he took notes, he did not take verbatim or exact notes. He took them for the purpose of refreshing his recollection to shortly thereafter, which was his normal practice, write a 302 FBI report. In this case, he didn't follow that normal practice, which, by the way, is also required by the FBI. He wrote his 302 five and a half months after the interview. At the trial, he was unable to testify as to the exact questions asked. As a matter of fact, he didn't really testify as to what questions prompted the answers that are charged. He was unable to talk about the exact answers that were given by my client, and he was unable to really give the jury a context. His notes, which he said he had to rely heavily on because his report was so late, is different from his testimony, which is different from the indictment charges. All of those factors go to the insufficiency not only of proving what statements John Sullivan made, but what he intended. And again, that's what Martellano and Jiang look at. I've raised the issue of fundamental ambiguity, which the government has answered. I'm not going to argue that here. What Martellano says is, even if the question is not fundamentally ambiguous, and you must look at the context, and you must impose a burden on the government in these types of cases to ask a precise question and get a precise answer. Otherwise, the jury is guessing at the defendant's intent. And that is exactly what happened here. I'd also note that as to the falsity of the statements themselves, the first statement that was charged is that Sullivan never heard of members of Catalinic's organization getting preferential treatment. There's absolutely no evidence, and in my reply brief, I've addressed every witness, every document the government talks about, there's absolutely no evidence John Sullivan knew that Catalinic's, that members of Catalinic's organization were getting preferential treatment. Catalinic himself testified and did not put John Sullivan involved in that at all. Catalinic testified that he went to other people for purposes of preferential treatment for his members. Drumgold, who said he told John Sullivan that he was receiving names from IGA, never said that those names were related to politics, and particularly did not say those names were related to Catalinic. As a matter of fact, the record suggests Drumgold didn't even know who the political sponsors of those people were. Mr. Bylina testified nothing about Catalinic. Mr. Foy testified about his own membership in telling Mr. Sullivan about that membership, but not about preferential treatment. The document the government relies on is a document everyone testified was being made from recommendations from supervisors and managers. Catalinic is a was a supervisor and a manager at the time. As to this last question, I think I have want to take just a couple of seconds about the identity of the members of Catalinic's organization. Hauser testified that John Sullivan did not say he did not know any of the members, and that so that statement cannot be read to exclude his knowledge of the few people that Foyt testified he mentioned were members. That question was asked in the context, and the notes show it, of a question about people getting preferential treatment and hiring, and a comment, I don't know about that. I don't know the members. It's a more narrow. But Hauser himself said, never asked the general question of membership. He did not answer, I don't know any of the members. And so if the agent's understanding is that, we certainly cannot let a conviction stand on a different understanding that it's not that Sullivan did not have and that contradicts the evidence. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Giacchetti. We'll hear now from Mr. Miller.
May it please the court, Barry Miller for the United States. Sorich, McCarthy, and Slattery were convicted of a scheme to defraud involving thousands of false statements, two sets of books, the destruction of computer and paper records, and concealment in order to take money from the city of Chicago by falsifying personnel records. By participating in this money and property fraud, defendants also misused their offices and breached their duties of honest services to the city and to its people. Unlike Thompson, this is not a case of public servants acting at their peril despite their good faith. This case, unlike Thompson, involves the clear use of false statements to take money containing many indicia of fraud, the concealment, the two sets of books, the shredding of computer files and paper records, sham interviews with tests that never mattered.
Well, here, we certainly don't have a typical mail fraud scheme because there's no payoffs, no kickbacks, no bribes. And this whole issue of the private gain of the defendants, I mean, I want you to deal with that language in Thompson and also try to give me, if you think Thompson doesn't cover this, what kind of rule we should have on this private gain and what the limits should be on private gain.
Maybe that would be a good place for you to begin. Does the circuit have it wrong?
The circuit's cases can be entirely harmonized, Your Honor. I noticed Mr. Klein did not refer to Spano, a 1346 case that makes the point, consistent with the other cases in this circuit about mail fraud, that private gain can go to self or others. Spano is entirely consistent with Lombardo and other cases.
But Spano says the gain can go to another member of the scheme. It doesn't say anything about gain to non-members, does it?
It says entirely altruistic. It can be entirely altruistic. If someone commits a fraud, whether a private or public employer intends to commit fraud against their employer, falsifies documents, and takes money and misapplies it, if they give the money to themselves, that's a mail fraud, assuming the mails are used, and an honest services fraud. And it can be just the same mail fraud or honest services fraud if they direct the money to their brother-in-law. The kinds of Thompson, what the Thompson turned on, Your Honors, was the absence of intent to defraud, and the court found there wasn't intent to defraud. It mentions it, presumes it. But putting that aside, there's the absence of intent to defraud, which through misuse of office caused unintended private gain. Thompson was posited by the court to be acting in good faith and did her acts based on innocent actions seeking what she saw or arguably saw as a political result that was fair, that was acceptable to the under the, what the court wrote. That's very different circumstances from here, where defendants intended that city money be taken through fraud. The object of the fraud was to misdirect or divert city money from the defendants, from the city to specified individuals, some of whom were co-schemers and some of whom were not. In the Thompson case itself, the court notes that it would be a different case if there was evidence that Thompson knew there were going to be contributions to the governor and intended that she was taking action in order to cause contributions to the governor. Here, there was overwhelming evidence that these defendants intended to commit fraud and to divert resources for political purposes and for other purposes to intended beneficiaries.
Were any of those intended beneficiaries members of the conspiracy or the scheme?
Yes, Your Honor, some of them were. For example, Mr. Tomczak testified that as a political coordinator, it enhanced his power as a public official and as a coordinator for jobs to be conditioned on promotion.
Is that the kind of gain that Thompson would allow us to recognize?
We think there are three kinds of gain in this case that Thompson allows you to recognize. One is the money that was intended to be the result of the fraud that went to the political workers and other people who received the jobs through false statements. The second is the
false statements of the workers themselves?
No, through false statements of these defendants and their co-schemers.
Thank you.
Second, the free political labor that was given to the coordinators and political organizations, and the coordinators are identified as co-schemers in the indictment and in the Santiago proffer. That's a second kind of private gain, and the free labor of hundreds of individuals, of course, has value that was intended as a result of the scheme. The third kind is Thompson discussed the psychic benefit of job security and a salary raise in due course for a civil service employee as being insufficient to show private gain. In this case, these employees were not civil service employees, and we submit that does make a difference. Here, these employees were what's called Shackman-exempt employees, policymaking employees, and there was evidence they all came from political backgrounds who were in these positions because they were participating in the scheme. There was evidence, for example, that Mara Georges, the corporation counsel, testified that IGA picked personnel directors of the various agencies. Mr. Drumgoole testified he was picked by Mr. Sorich to be put in this position. Many of the Shackman-exempt people who testified that they understood they had to go along in order to keep their jobs or get advancement. It's fair to infer that these people got their jobs and stayed in their jobs because they were willing to go along. So that is a private gain that's distinguishable from what the court found insufficient in Thompson.
Who put them in those jobs?
They were put in these defendants?
Yes. I sort of look at this. You mentioned the word power. Power and prestige. They're in a position of power.
Correct.
Now, who put them in that position?
The testimony was that Mr. Sorich put Mr. Slattery in his position.
Okay, where'd Sorich come from?
Mr. Sorich was in IGA. At the end, he was assistant to the director. There was testimony about his regular meetings and dealings with the director of IGA, who was Victor Reyes for part of the scheme and John Doerr for part of the scheme. Mr. McCarthy had been installed as a personal director in aviation, presumably by Mr. Sorich from inference from the other testimony, and then was promoted into this position, again, presumably by Mr. Sorich and the director of IGA, describing how the system worked. The director of IGA is a mayoral appointment.
A mayoral appointment?
Correct.
And he would be appointed Sorich?
And the director appointed Sorich and McCarthy, yes.
See, where does all this go?
Where does all of this go?
Yeah, where does this power, you know, that descends, where does it come from?
Eventually, it comes from the office of the mayor. What Commissioner Kasiba, for example, testified was that he viewed, and others did as testified as well, IGA was above them. They had to follow IGA's directives to stay in their positions, and that specifically included Mr. Sorich and Mr. McCarthy.
So it's this retention of power and, I guess, whatever else you want to do, the power to select and to appoint and to displace others that is part of that. Is that part of the violation? Does that go beyond money and property?
It goes beyond money and property to show that they were receiving a benefit both direct and indirect from the private gain that they were causing. There's also indirect benefit language in some of the cases. We think that their salary was a direct benefit, but it's also an indirect benefit supporting the private gain. And again, the difference with Thompson is here, in this case, the object of the fraud was to take the city's money and put it to a private use. And that was the intended object of the fraud. So when counsel asks where the limiting principle is, the limiting principle that it can be drawn from this court's cases is that intent to defraud and misuse of office causing private gain as an intended result is an honest services fraud. That's consistent with all of these this court's cases, including Spano, including Lombardo, including Walters, and including Thompson.
So then your position is basically the public is deprived of honest services no matter who gets the proceeds. I mean, is that in terms of the private gain?
Correct.
If it's a situation where there's fraud and all those other things that
correct.
You outline.
That's correct, Your Honor. And what counsel is urging is that 1341 and 1343 be split off from 1346. 1346 is a different way of violating 1341 and 1343, the mail and wire fraud statutes. It provides a different approach of liability, but it's not an entirely separate violation. And there's no reason why private gain that's an intended loss from the fraud should be treated separately from under 1346 than under the mail and wire fraud statutes, where there are many cases of this court saying that the defendants don't have to get personal direct benefit from the fraud as long as they intended to cause a loss or gain. And 1346 is the same way, and Spano correctly reads it the same way. Spano applies the standard fraud principles of this circuit as to private gain directly to the honest services fraud. Thompson doesn't purport to overrule Spano. Thompson has hypotheticals that assume that it's a different case if there was intended private gain to the governor by contributions or someone else. Thompson is consistent with this court's line of authority and doesn't affect what occurred in this case.
Of course, even if we were to accept your argument, we have the problem of what the jury instructions said. But the jury instructions still appear to be inadequate.
Respectfully, Your Honor, the jury instructions accurately state that a private gain was required to self or others, which is what Spano says and is and has been the law of the circuit. We think that the jury instructions track Spano and appropriately correct, taken with all the instructions together, requiring intent to defraud and defining it.
Even with your rendition of Thompson?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the instructions are consistent with my rendition of Thompson. If you think that there is an element lacking in some respect in the instructions, you still should affirm, because under the Nieder case, even if an element were missing, where the evidence is overwhelming as it was here, you can find that there was harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt, because the same acts that were at issue were the acts that supported the other convictions of fraud. It also wasn't harped on below that the defendant's salary was the basis for the honest services fraud. While it was mentioned in connection with the theft of the services and money of the jobs and of the free political workers. So it would be harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt, Your Honor, under Nieder and other cases, even if you were to find the instructions inadequate. With respect to the comments about mailings.
Of course, we don't have a special verdict form here to say under what theory the jury convicted, do we?
We don't, Your Honor.
And wouldn't that have been helpful?
in retrospect, it might have been helpful.
And then isn't that a problem, then, if we find that there, the evidence is sufficient under one theory but not under the other, and we don't know which the jury found?
You know, there is a negligible risk in this case, Your Honor, that the jury based its findings solely on an improper theory. Given the nature of the evidence, which was the same evidence as to fraud and as to the result of the fraud, this isn't a case where there's any real risk that they relied entirely on one theory and not on another. With respect to the issue of mailings, the Fernandez case makes clear the law in this circuit, and that the law is everywhere, that if the success of the scheme depends on making it appear that a regular activity is going on, that can be incident, that it could be a mailing incident to the success of the fraudulent scheme, and that's sufficient. Judge Williams referred to the Henderson mailing. That mailing contained falsehoods on its face, even though that's not required that a mailing do that. And the key here wasn't any particular mailing fooling any particular recipient as much as it was the mailings as a whole. The apparent regularity of the personnel process was designed to fool the Shackman plaintiffs, a court, anyone who looked at this process, as though they really were conducting regular mailings and a regular personnel process and not engaging in the massive fraud that they were engaging in.
But that mailing took place 5 months later.
It's not clear when the mailing took place with respect to the decisions. That's not true. And that's the mailing with respect to count five, I believe, we're talking about, which is the harness mailing. A mailing to a loser saying you didn't get the job is something that is part of any normal personnel practice. And while that particular mailing, the timing of that, which again is not entirely clear from the record as to when it is compared to the actual job decisions, and there were a series of job decisions on building inspectors during that year. The testimony is that there were several rounds that took place starting in January going through, I believe, July when the actual fraud occurred with these people. And there may have been an additional round after that. I don't recall whether that's true or not. The mailing's importance was to the scheme as a whole, to conceal the scheme as a whole, as well as to each individual sequence. And it was apparent not that any one mailing fooled just Mr. Harness, but that it fooled anyone who looked at the entire personnel practice at the city to see whether it was regular or not. With respect to Mr. Slattery's intent, the facts in Thompson didn't show intent. This court made it clear here that the facts didn't show intent. Here, the jury was properly instructed on intent, and there was ample evidence to support that verdict. The defendant shared Mr. Drumgoole's office. He went with Mr. Drumgoole to Mr. Sorich on many occasions. On one occasion, he brought the names from Mr. Sorich himself, people to promote in the Electricity Bureau. That's a transcript 1350. And those people were, in fact, then hired. The fact that he completed hundreds of forms inaccurately, knowing they were inaccurate, takes this case far away from Thompson and shows that he was intent. And if there was, had the intent, and if there were any question left about his intent or the legitimacy of his conduct, it was resolved by his conversations with Ms. Hennessy, which the jury was entitled to conclude showed that he was intending to conceal the scheme and not explaining that these were picks that came from supervisors, from IGA, and he knew where picks came from because he was with Mr. Drumgoole when they went to Mr. Sorich all the time. Unlike Thompson, there's nothing legitimate about Mr. Slattery's conduct here. There are no bona fides of what he was doing. He did argue these factual points below, but the jury was entitled to conclude to the contrary, and there's sufficient evidence to support the verdict. With respect to Mr. Sullivan, the questions weren't verbatim, but weren't testified to verbatim, but there's no requirement that they have to be. What counsel's argument resolves to is that it's just a sufficiency argument. The testimony that the jury heard was specific as to what Mr. Sullivan said, and the jury properly concluded it was false and there was an intent to deceive.
But the FBI agent who interviewed him couldn't recall exactly what was said. He relied on his notes. His 302 was done many months later.
He relied on?
That's problematic, isn't it? Especially when we're looking at a perjury charge.
It's a false statement charge, Your Honor. He relied on his notes. It was done many months later, and it could have been clearer if there were a verbatim transcript. But there are many 1001 cases that do not involve verbatim transcripts. And he testified very clearly and very firmly, and he was cross-examined on it, and he testified very clearly as to the key points of the testimony.
Well, didn't the
jury concluded
notes,
was false.
Didn't the agent's notes just provide the answers, not even the question that was put to him?
The agent's notes were neither verbatim question nor answers. They weren't admitted into evidence, but he testified, refreshing his recollection from the notes, as to what his recollection was as the testimony. And the points that he testified to that were the grounds for conviction were clear, and the jury was properly instructed about what it needed to find. In discussing the intent question, or the intent to commit a falsehood, Mr. Sullivan's brief takes one point at a time, and counsel's argument takes one point at a time. But the jury was entitled to consider all of those points taken together. The fact that Mr. Sullivan was filling out color-coded lists showing whose people were whom. The fact that he gave names to Mr. Bylina. I believe counsel said that Bylina said nothing. He gave names to Mr. Bylina on one occasion of the pre-selected winners. Mr. Drumgoole testified that he regularly let Mr. Sullivan know about the names coming from IGA. The fact that after the second interview, where the charges occurred, he called back to say that he'd been thinking about the answers, but he wanted to tell more and then didn't change these answers. In his third interview, his phone interview, didn't say anything that was incriminating to anyone when there was evidence that he had this knowledge, some of which I've summarized, the rest is in our brief, supports the conclusion that he was concealing the true facts of which he was aware. Agent Hauser testified, transcript 3039, the defendant was asked whether hiring, promotions, or overtime were affected in any way by political factors. He went back to that subject at the third interview, but didn't change the false statements he had made at the second interview. And the fact that he didn't makes this a jury question. There wasn't an ambiguity about those statements. The testimony was sufficiently definite to support the conviction. If the court has no further questions, would ask the court to affirm the judgments below.
Well, I just want to get back to this Thompson case again and the cites that counsel read from the briefs, because I understand your theory that it was not fraudulent intent with respect to Thompson and that this was innocent behavior. But when you look at the argument that the U.S. Attorney's Office made in Milwaukee in the briefs, that certainly doesn't suggest innocent behavior. How do you address that?
The court in Thompson case reviewed that record and found, if you look at the language of the Thompson opinion, talks about that there was no showing that she intended through fraud for it to go, for private gain to go to the governor, that she didn't have knowledge that things were going to the governor. Here, there is a key difference. The entire purpose of this conduct, for which there is no question that there was fraudulent conduct, was to take the money directly from the victim and give it for private use. In Thompson, there was no finding of intent to defraud, and there was no connection between the fraud and the diversion of funds improperly. And there were more than arguable proper purposes for her conduct, proper actions for her conduct. Here, IGA concealed its role in Shackman-covered hiring. They concealed it from the Corporation Council. They lied about it. They shredded the records. And their very purpose, unlike Thompson, was clearly to take government money and violate their duty of honest services by making all of these lies and taking the money and diverting it to private use of co-schemers and others.
In the end, others, I assume, are the people who didn't get the job, or is this somebody else.
The other beneficiaries were the people who did get the job. They may not have technically been co-schemers
I should have said victim. I think that the way it's worded, the city and the people are the victim.
Yes, Your Honor. There's
and I just wondered if because there was some discussion of this as being the victim being those who got the letter saying you didn't get the job and when they maybe otherwise should have.
That's a point that was argued in the briefs, Your Honor. The indictment charged and the government proved that the city and the people of the city were the legal victims who had their money and property diverted by the defendant's breach of their duties of honest services. In a colloquial sense, people who didn't get the jobs are also victims in the sense that they were harmed. But it came up in trial, not that we were arguing that they were the victim of the scheme. What came up in trial was the defendants were arguing a variety of arguments. There was no harm. This was all being done for affirmative action, a number of other arguments. And so there was testimony about, in order to both prove the fraud and to respond to the defenses raised in the case, there was testimony about individuals who did not receive jobs, and it is true that they were harmed by not receiving the jobs.
But so and others are the people who got the jobs, then?
The and others, for purposes of private gain, are the people who got the jobs who may not have known that there was a falsification process in place, so they did not have criminal intent.
Yeah, but I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. Finish. I'm sorry.
But that doesn't mean that they didn't receive a private gain that was intended by the defendants.
I'd like to look at this Spano case again because, of course, the bottom line, as you pointed out, is that the court determined that in a successful scheme, the public is deprived of its servants' honest services no matter who receives the proceeds. But earlier in that decision, the court talked about a participant in a scheme to defraud is guilty even if he is an altruist and all the benefits of the fraud accrue to other participants. And so if you look at that language, I mean, I understand what the bottom line was of the court, but isn't that problematic for you?
Your Honor, I think the case needs to be read as a whole, and with the other 1341 precedent in this circuit, such as Lombardo, and there are other cases as well, it's well established that a victim is defrauded no matter who receives the benefit as long as the private gain is intended by the people who committed the fraud. How could these defendants not have breached their honest services duty if they intentionally took money from their employer and gave it to someone else? If it were a bank officer who dummied up a sham contract and used the mails and wired funds to his own account in Switzerland, whether it's his own account or whether it's his brother-in-law's account, and whether his brother-in-law knows about the result or not, knows about the fraud or not, the officer is still taking money from his employer, violating his duty of public of honest services in a private context, and intending that there be private gain. The same is true here in this context. It doesn't matter for the money and property fraud or for the honest services fraud if someone is violating clearly established policy and law and stealing from their employer, that has to be a breach of the duty of honest services. And there's no reason that 1346 should be construed separately on that point from the way all other mail frauds and wire frauds are construed, when the intent to defraud is clear and when the loss was caused by the intended fraud. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. How much time does the counsel have? You have 1 minute, sir.
1 minute.
So why don't you address Spano and why we shouldn't apply and read the case the way Mr. Miller does.
I will,
Your
Honor.
And that it doesn't, you know, and that Thompson didn't override that spinal conclusion.
The language that I believe Your Honor read and that counsel relies on in Spano is dictum. In Spano itself, the defendant, Ms. Lauren Maltese, gained personally. She got 100% reimbursement of her health expenses as opposed to the 80% to which she was entitled. Members of her family who were co-schemers also benefited. The language that Your Honor read first to Mr. Miller is also dictum, even if a person is an altruist and other participants gain. That is dictum as well, because Ms. Lauren Maltese herself personally gained from the scheme in Spano. And so there is no need to read Spano beyond those core facts, which fit perfectly with Bloom and with Thompson. It's just pure dictum, the rest of it. I believe Mr. Miller argued that in Thompson it was a question of intent, whether Ms. Thompson knew that there was going to be private gain to the governor. Well, she certainly knew that there was going to be $750,000 of private gain to Edelman Travel. That was the whole reason she allegedly manipulated the Wisconsin procurement process. But the court in Thompson, in giving a judgment of acquittal on her behalf on the private gain issue, evidently concluded that that was not enough. The government argued in its brief that that $750,000 was private gain. The court clearly didn't believe that it was.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. We'll hear now from Mr. Didi. He has 1 minute as well.
I'd like to get back to the mailing that Your Honor raised with respect to Mr. Harness and take issue with the government's position. The Harness letter actually is there's no overt falsity of the letter itself. It merely states, and I'll state it for the record, recently you were interviewed for a position of building inspector in the Department of Buildings. The letter is to inform you that we have filled the vacant position with another applicant. That's all the letter says. And I think that to suggest that that's somehow some overt falsity is really an incorrect statement of the record. But more importantly, I think when they rely on Fernandez, which this court has considered, there I think demonstrates what we're talking about with respect to the concealment aspects of that particular case, where the dummy corporations were set up by the individual defendants who submitted those phony applications and pre-applications for bids. Those were all things engineered, created, conceived by the participants of the scheme. Here, these letters to Mr. Harness, these letters to Mr. Henderson, were matters that just occurred in the regular course of business that nobody particularly cared about. And for those reasons, we think that both mailings were not in furtherance of the scheme and that Mr. McCarthy should be acquitted. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Didi. We'll hear now from Mr. Does Mr. Belgin have some time? You have 2 minutes, sir.
I guess it goes without saying, in response to the government's arguments about the Thompson case, the jury convicted Ms. Thompson, despite what the government now says about the evidence of her intent to defraud. But there's a couple of things that they said about Mr. Slattery's intent to defraud that I'd like to address. Mr. Miller said, I believe, that there are typical hallmarks of fraud in this case, a double set of books and the destruction of records. Neither of those have any connection to Slattery whatsoever. The double set of books, I assume he's referring to, is the kind of infamous clout list of people who got jobs and their sponsors. Slattery doesn't appear anywhere on that clout list as being a sponsor for anyone. Notably, his direct supervisor in personnel matters, Drumgold, appears in there, I believe, 6 or 7 times as being somebody's sponsor. With regard to the destruction of documents and computer records, that stuff all happened long before Slattery had anything to do with personnel in the city, and Judge Gore, in fact, instructed the jury that it had no applicability to Slattery. The government now says that Slattery completed hundreds of forms inaccurately. That's essentially what the court found that Ms. Thompson did. The government also relies on his conversation with Ms. Hennessy. Ms. Hennessy is set forth in my brief. There's at least a half dozen reasons she shouldn't be believed, mostly because she was one of Dan Catalinic's right-hand persons. But also, what Mr. Slattery said to her was not a lie. It didn't conceal anything. She asked him, please tell me there's a legitimate reason for the hiring decisions. Was it based on performance, attendance, or anything? And Slattery's response was no. That's hardly the response of someone who's trying to conceal a scheme to a lawyer who works for the city. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Belden. And Ms. Giacchetti has a minute.
The agent Hauser never really testified to what the questions were. He was on direct. He was just said, what did he say about this? What did he say about that? He was directed to the topic. On cross-examination, I even showed him the notes, because there are two lines, and said, well, is this the question and this the answer? He said, not that I recall. All he would finally say is that those were the statements, and he never said he didn't know any of the members. But Hauser, the only question about the only question that's specifically in the record about political factors didn't occur till a telephone conversation 4 days later. It was not in this interview. Mr. Sullivan was not charged with making any false statements in that telephone interview. The government keeps arguing, well, he should have volunteered the information he knew about IGA. Hauser testified he never asked him about IGA. He never directed the topics to IGA. As to his testimony, Hauser's testimony is if we walked in with a transcript that had the questions missing, and the court reporter said, I didn't take it down right. I didn't get it exactly. I didn't follow the procedures I normally follow to get it right, and then we sustained a conviction based on that type of testimony. I suggest that's unimaginable, and that's analogous to what happened here. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Giacchetti. The court would like to thank all counsel for their very fine briefs and very fine oral arguments today. The case will be taken under advisement.